If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Truth and Movies. Lynn Ramsey's You Were Never Really Here. Not the story of Trump's record at the White House, but whacking Phoenix with a whacking big hammer and using it. There's thunder from a land down under in Warwick Thornton's awesome Aussie Chase Western Sweet Country. And call it Generation Kill, Selma Blair and Nick Cage uncaged in infanticide fantasy Mom and Dad. All that plus a film club classic, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. That's Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. James Richardson, yep, that's me. Hannah Woodhead.
Hello.
Great news. Sophie Monks Kaufman.
Hi.
Sophie, it feels like ages that you haven't been here.
I was never really here.
Yeah. But you are here today.
Yes, and I'm going to hammer into those reviews.
Oh, nicely done.
I hate myself saying that.
No, you've also been in close personal contact with two of the protagonists.
Yes.
Of one of the movies that we're looking at today.
Absolutely.
We've got a lot to discuss today because there's loads of comments here. There's also, Hannah, been the Oscars, which you sat up and watched.
I did for my sins.
All right. Do you want to give us 60 seconds on the Oscars?
Yeah.
What was the best bit? What was the worst bit?
The best bit was seeing Guillermo del Toro clutching a 6-foot sub sandwich.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was just great. Just really bizarre. And his little face when he won Best Picture, checking the envelope and then holding it up and being like, yep, I've got it. Not a moonlight moment.
Was the submarine thing, was that a play on the fact that it's a subaquatic hero?
It wasn't. I think Jimmy Kimmel, he took loads of stars across the road to meet some members of the public, you know, and as they do every year, it's like, oh, look, celebrities just like real people. But yeah, they got Guillermo to bring in this massive sandwich. It was just really like bizarre.
Like ordinary people have every day.
Exactly, yeah. Giving the people what they want, big sandwiches.
All right.
Yeah, I do find those segments really patronising.
They're so bad every year.
If that was the best bit, what was the worst?
Oh, gosh. It was just quite boring. Uh-huh. There was a very bizarre moment where they just played this montage of war movies.
Mm-hmm. Sure, life is war.
Yeah.
What was the rationale for that?
I don't know. A veteran came on, and you have to forgive my ignorance, I can't remember the context because I sort of tuned out by this point, but he said, I served in Vietnam. Anyone else? Which I thought was very, like, okay.
Right.
Then they just had this weird segment with war movies, and then it was like, and back to the awards.
Okay. But,
yeah, and it felt so long. It went on and on and on.
Right. Don't they? Hey, speaking of Guillermo del Toro, we've got a bulging mailbag this week. And even the briefest of dips into it, it can't fail to bring out the kind of magnum opus that Chance Hamrow sent in. Chance Hamrow, who's left bewildered by The Shape of Water. Everyone, says Chance, seems to love it. But I found it so bad that I almost left the theatre early, which I haven't done since. A film called The Goods Live Hard, Sell Hard. Do you know that film?
I don't, but I read this email. He really did not care for Shape of Water.
No. I'm actually on side a lot of what Chance says. My feelings about Shape of Water is it's a beautiful film. I mean, stylistically, it's gorgeous and impossible to fault, but it left me utterly cold. The storyline just felt like an exercise in storytelling as opposed to an actual organic thing. Chance Hamrow basically says, can the pod find some critic who doesn't like it? I'm legitimately confused by how much recognition it's received.
Can I recommend that he tracks down a review by Adam Neyman for, I think it's for Reverse Shot, but if he searches Adam Neyman's review, it's a very, very thoughtful takedown.
Takedown of the film.
So this could give him some catharsis.
Okay.
To read Adam Neyman on The Shape of Water.
Right. I can't not recognise the skill involved in putting it together. and some of the performances as well, but it just looked like the whole thing was filmed through fairy liquid for me.
Who would have been your pick for Best Picture, out of curiosity?
Oh, the film that I probably left the cinema most excited by in the past 12 months was Three Billboards, but I've since kind of been retro-engineered with a slightly different view on it by you know, other people's opinions. I really like Three Billboards.
My favourite film of last year actually was one we're going to be discussing today, You Were Never Really Here.
Ah, wow, which I haven't seen
wasn't
yet.
Even eligible for right. the Academy Awards
actually,
last year.
Can I go Phantom Thread?
Oh, yeah, good choice.
Yeah, love that.
Yeah, Sophie's completely right. Ooh,
here's Mark Woodruff on the subject of Phantom Thread, who says, I read that J-Lord, Jennifer Lawrence, left Phantom Thread after 3 minutes, which seems implausible, says Mark. That's what she claimed anyway. What are your thoughts on the matter? The article said that leaving a bad play at the interval was more exhilarating than seeing a good play because it's like bunking off school and realising you have a whole day of possibility ahead of you. I completely agree with this. Have you ever left a movie halfway? You walk out and suddenly you've got freedom. Everyone else is still trapped in there and you've got the entire world before you with free time.
It's a wonderful feeling. It does feel like you've somehow cheated the system whereby you constantly lose time and have, in fact, gained some time. Although the only time in recent memory that I've done that...
What film was it?
To my shame, I can't remember. It was a very austere Russian film that was at London Film Festival about 4 years ago. But there was a slapstick moment because I tried to sneak out unobtrusively but accidentally booted someone's walking stick into the aisle, which made an almighty noise and obviously made me look like a bad guy. Yeah, but obviously I returned it to the owner and then dashed off into the sunshine and freedom.
All right.
I've never done it.
Seriously, you've never left?
I have sat through some truly awful movies, but I feel like I want my money's worth, and if I sit through it, I'm then allowed to be mean about it. So, you know.
All right. Fair enough. Astro Whiz, I was quite looking forward to Red Sparrow, which I bet you were tempted to walk out of, Hannah.
You know what? I wasn't, just because I was sitting there thinking, oh, I'm going to write some good content about this film. Ah. This film is truly awful. I can't wait to write about it.
You did write a very interesting piece about quite why the film is bad, which I must admit, to me watching it, which I did after our last edition, I wasn't immediately conscious of the negative thing that you... I would urge people to go and read yours. The thing that Astro Whiz mentions is the spectrum, the panoply of bad accents, which really took them out of the movie. I think it can affect an actor's performance also, says Astro Whiz. Sometimes I feel they're concentrating so hard on the accent they lose another aspect of the delivery. Like, and what a great analogy this is, rubbing your tummy and patting your head at the same time. Yeah, my feelings as well when you hear an actor consciously chewing on an accent. We'll just finish off with one other message. This is from Steve Burkery. I do hope I pronounced that correctly. I've just learned that HBO is going to release a new documentary on the life and career of Andre the Giant. It prompts me to suggest The Princess Bride as a candidate for film club. For me, it is as close to the perfect film as I can imagine. Ooh, that's a strong choice.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of Princess Bride. Soz everyone. This might be connected to my childhood because my sister had a VHS of it and would watch it incessantly.
Right.
So that, for me, maybe put me off it. I do love Andre the Giant, though. I'm excited to watch this documentary. HBO make the best documentaries.
Okay.
So that sounds good. I'm glad that's been brought to my attention.
But you're not down for Princess Bride as film club?
I just think it's got a very nostalgic feel for a lot of people, which is probably why they like it. But
okay. I first saw it as an adult, and I think probably a lot of people did. But still, it's one we'll, I hope, get a chance to discuss. I'd like to get it in as a film club, although, Sophie, as we were discovering before, half the problem is everybody has already seen it.
Yeah, it's already a classic, and I think a good job of film club is to elevate titles that maybe might be in danger of getting lost.
Titles like Street Fighter, which I believe is David Jenkins' nomination.
No, Adam Woodward.
Was it Adam Woodward?
Adam Woodward is going to be on the show next week.
And he wants us to watch Street Fighter.
Yeah, he wants you all to go away and watch Street Fighter. I can only apologise. I was not involved in this decision.
Well, I don't.
It's in honour of Tomb Raider. There's a kind of cult
JCVD, Kylie Minogue.
It's a very strange cast. But we sort of went through them. And, you know, there's the original Tomb Raider films. There was a Tekken film. There was Mario and Luigi
Mortal
film.
Kombat.
Mortal Kombat. Yep. Several Mortal Kombat. Resident Evil, you know.
The Mario and Luigi film starring, of course, Sir Bob Hoskins.
Yeah.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
I think we're going to come back to this a little bit later
on. Yes, let's
do
it, yeah.
Unless we're all going to pile back to Adam Woodward's at 12:30 with cans, I can't see a scenario that would make revisiting Street Fighter worth it just for Adam to appear clever about it next week. Sorry about that, Adam. We'll talk more anyway later on about that. If you want to get in touch, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com is the email address, at LWLies on Twitter. We're on Facebook. And, of course, there's a comment section at the Little White Lies website. Time now for our first movie, and it is You Were Never Really Here. Sophie and Hannah, you've both seen this film. I haven't. Yes. My little summary here is that you've got a traumatised and violent veteran, played by Joaquin Phoenix, who tracks down missing girls for a living, but then a job spins out of control and his nightmares overtake him. Does that set us up for this?
It doesn't, it doesn't. But we can unpick it, because the glory of this film is that it takes a storyline that maybe might be familiar, and because of the extraordinary artists involved, turns it into something completely astonishing. So I don't think you could do justice to it in a synopsis, because it's super. So much more.
Well, let's hear a clip from it then, eh? This is Joaquin Phoenix talking to somebody about doing bad things.
235 East 31st Street. That's what the text said. You have kids, Joe?
No.
Nina. Her name is Nina. I've heard of these places. Underage girls.
Senator, if she's there, I'll get her.
Cleary said you were brutal.
And it can be.
I need this.
You get this address, 3 a.m. Hotel Carib, room 701.
I want you to hurt them.
Now, Sophie, you have a very nice interview with Joaquin Phoenix, who may or may not be joking in it, published on the Little White Lies website at the moment. He comes across as quite a playful fellow, not at all the kind of hammer-wielding nightmare of this movie.
No, and he was absolutely at pains to dispel the idea of being a serious actor, even though he definitely is a serious actor.
When I was in Berlin, I went to the press conference for Don't Worry, You Won't Get Far on Foot, and he was at the press conference, and he's completely at odds with the person in You Were Never Really Here, which is obviously a massive testament to his talent.
But wow. They call it acting.
Wow, I was sat there mind blown. And I think it's the same with You Never Really. People are like, oh, how can you play these characters? And he's like, I'm an actor. he famously doesn't like doing interviews very much.
Right.
And he says quite a lot of the time, like, oh, how do you prepare for these really difficult roles? And he's like, I'll just turn up and do my job, which I think is kind of the vibe you get reading that interview.
Did he seem uncomfortable with the press one? Were you seeing him as one of those kind of schedule junket type interviews?
Yeah, he was very charming. It was a charm offensive, I would say. He was chatting with everyone. He was smoking. He was very charming. And I think it's a very smart strategy to be lighthearted in public-facing roles, because you conserve that darkness that you want to explore in movies for that sphere. And nobody is just one thing, and he's got access to these very deep and profound feelings that he's able to channel. But why would he want to channel those all of the time? Like, when he's facing the press, that's a time for him to monkey about.
All right, very nice. By the way, a charm offensive is completely oxymoronic, isn't it? Very interesting phrase. Now, you also interviewed Lynn Ramsey, who's the director, who I believe had only one choice for the central character in this film, and it was Joaquin Phoenix. Does he live up to this?
Absolutely. She said that as soon as she began writing it, and it's an adaptation of a novella by Jonathan Ames, as soon as she began writing her adaptation, she just stuck up a picture on her computer of Joaquin Phoenix. He was the only person she could envisage.
Like there wasn't one there already, eh?
Well, exactly. So this central character that he plays is a figure we've seen in the movies before. He's this Lone Ranger type. Peace. So the line that you would have heard in the clip where the senator says, I hear you're brutal, and he says, it can be, is such a quiet delivery. And everything he says is so reined in. He doesn't actually have that many lines of dialogue. He's transformed physically. He's got this very precise look. He's strong and capable, but he's not super muscly. He's let his built body run to flab, and he just kind of shuffles around, and he speaks quietly, and he's just not who you would visually imagine this badass hammer-wielding guy that goes in to save kids to look like. And in everything that he does, even though he's the central hero or the anti-hero, he feels so full of pain and suffering. He's suicidal. It's a very tender, loving portrait for a character that's typically portrayed as some slick badass.
Lynn Ramsey goes to quite lengths to get that nuance. She has these wonderful moments where he's talking to his mother, or when he encounters a cat, which is like my favourite bit in the film. He sat stroking this cat and he says, "Where's your papa?" Like really softly. And I've seen this film 3 times now. Like, I cannot get enough of this film. What a performance. It just blows my mind that someone can get that so right.
Lynn Ramsey, who's previously enjoyed huge success with Ratcatcher, More Than Caller, and we need to talk about Kevin, which I was too squeamish to see. How am I going to deal with this one?
Oh, I think this is worse than when you talk about Kevin in terms of violence. But the interesting thing about this is, so the whole marketing campaign for this has been about the hammer.
Uh-huh.
I don't think it features that much. I think you'll be surprised if you go into this expecting a film that is like a violent, like, John Wick's a perfect example. If you go in expecting this kind of like revenge saga, it's not that at all. It's a lot quieter.
Also, I'd really like to pipe up to just say, don't be scared of the violence, because what makes her one of my favourite living filmmakers is she's very image-driven in her cinema. She studied photography and art, and you can see this in the way she beautifully composes images. It's all a balance of dark and light, of nightmares and dreams. So whatever violence there might be, it's not heavy, it's not overwhelming, it's not oppressive, because there's this life force pushing back. And she just gets this really complicated, confusing, but therefore magnificent place with her films that is just so the opposite of anything simplistic or moralizing. And it's to do with the human soul. And that's like a cheesy thing to say, but all of her films are about the human soul and how complicated a place it is. And yes, there's blood and there's darkness and there's violence and there's stuff that could break your heart, but there's also this really delicate life force that could break your heart for the opposite reason, because it's hope. So please don't be deterred from any of her 4 films, because they're all masterpieces. I mean, masterpiece is 1 film. They're all tremendous works of art.
Okay, magnificent. Hannah, would you like to give this some scores?
Yeah, I'll give it exactly the same as I gave it in my review, which is 4.55. I just want to say about Lynn Ramsey, so I first encountered her when I was 18 at university, and I went to see We Need to Talk About Kevin, and it was a really nice sunny afternoon in Leeds. Went to the Hyde Park Pitch House, great cinema if you're ever in Leeds, and I watched it on my own, and I came out and I was just like floored. I remember that walk home, like it was about a 10-minute walk from the cinema to my house, and I remember just like, I felt like I couldn't breathe. Like, I've never had such a visceral reaction to a film. And I had that same reaction to this. I think it is just, Lynn Ramsey is an absolutely fantastic woman, fantastic talent, and this film is mind-blowing in every sense of the word.
An absolute must-see.
We
Sophie.
Must also shout out to Johnny Greenwood's score, because what a 1-2,
yes.
Phantom Thread and You Are Never Really Here. And they're both really different types of scores.
Completely different. But you can, I thought this time, I went to see it again on Monday, you can see the DNA. You can tell it's a Johnny Greenwood score, but they are so, so different. And if he doesn't get an Oscar nomination for this next year, having lost this year, which was a total crime, he should have won Phantom Thread. But
no, it's fine, because he operates in the highest sphere. Oscars is just an industry popularity contest, but I don't think Johnny Greenwood cares. I mean,
I don't think he does.
Who am I to speak for Johnny Greenwood? Here am I, his personal rep. But because Joaquin Phoenix doesn't have that many lines of dialogue, this kind of fills in for his interior world, and it's so dark and dissonant and yet like so melodic and specific.
Sophie, your numbers?
5.55.
5.55. It's going to be, I think, on quite limited release. I think there's a Lynn Ramsey Q&A on this Thursday, the 8th,
yes,
at a Curzon in London, depending on when you're listening to this.
Yeah, Curzon as well. We have done a little competition with them. We put a creative brief out asking artists to submit portraits of Joaquin, and we're having an exhibition at Curzon Soho. So if you're in the area, go and have a look at the winners. They are really, really, like, tip-top.
Golly, I'm really looking forward to seeing it now. Let's move on to Sweet Country. Sweet Country is an Australian Western set in the Northern Territory in the 1920s. Sam, a middle-aged Aboriginal Australian man, works for a preacher, but when First World War veteran Harry moves into a neighbouring outpost, the preacher, played by Sam Neill, reluctantly lends him Sam's services, sparking an epic hunt and Fight for Justice. Based on a true story, here's a clip of a key moment.
I've come to ask a favour. I need to fix up my trap yard. I was wondering if you could help me. I can offer you rum and tobacco.
No, mate. We don't drink here at Black Hill. We don't smoke neither. I'd be happy to go give you a hand, but I'm heading into town in a day or two.
Well, what about him?
Sam. No, I can't spare him. I need someone here to keep an eye on the place.
I mean, it'd only be for a day, two at most. You know, it'd be the Christian thing to do.
Sam! This is Harry March. He's taken over North Creek Station. Could you go and give him a hand for a couple of days? Could you do that, you and your wife?
Well, I'd say this movie has two trump cards, neither of which say very much. One is Australia, and the other one is Hamilton Moss as Sam.
Sam, yeah, I mean, Hamilton Moss is absolutely fantastic. Like, just brilliant. And, yeah, just the way it's shot is, like, fantastic. We were having this conversation a little bit earlier. I was really sad to be watching this at home. I wish I'd seen it on a big screen. I think it would really benefit from seeing it there. In Australia, my grandpa actually worked in Alice Springs in the 50s.
Okay, where this is set.
Where this is set. And my uncle now lives in Australia. And in Britain, it's maybe not something we're as aware of, the treatment of Aboriginal Australians, but it's pretty appalling even today. And this film really kind of shines a light on that. And it's absolutely brutal. It's a really harrowing watch. But it's completely necessary. It's a very, like, sensitive and, yeah, timely movie. This is still something in 2018 that Aboriginal people in Australia are still having to kind of, like, fight relentlessly just to get the same rights as white Australians. And a disproportionate amount of Aboriginal children are in detention centres in Australia.
I found Hamilton Moss really interesting, also because of the way that his performance, it's almost like an absence of performance. Things happen to him that normally would elicit, particularly in a dramatic movie, would elicit a range of emotions. But it's that absence of emotion which tells its own story. And I think that's something he shares with the rest of the kind of Aboriginal Australians or Australian Aboriginals. I'm not sure what the right term would be in this. But particularly him, the way he anchors this, all this stuff happens to him. And there's none of the usual tricks that an actor would use to denote their response. It's a very subtle performance. It's a subtle film for all its grand sweeping splendour of the scenery and the drama of its actual plotline.
What comes across to me in this film is how entrenched the dehumanisation of Aboriginal Australians has been. And, yeah, Hamilton Moss, the things that happened to Sam just happened to him. And there's a sense that he is powerless. And I feel like other films about similar issues are very much like, fight, fight, fight. And this is just what happens when you can't fight anymore and you just become resigned to your fate, which is kind of what happens to him. And it's, I do have my issues with it. I think there's a little bit of leaning towards kind of like white saviourism. But I think it's the closest I've seen. Maybe Rabbit Proof Fence is a good companion to this. I think this is an important movie about a very, very sensitive issue in Australia.
Mm. And it's also, I found, a more entertaining watch than I thought it was going to be. There's a long period which kind of, even though Butch and Sundance, you know, the posse chase in Butch and Sundance, were my favourite bits of cinema. And there's a similar reliance on scenery and just the action speaking for itself in this film. Is it interesting? I was reading an interview with Warwick Thornton where he says, basically, I grew up loving Westerns. I read this screenplay. It was just beautiful. Back in Alice Springs, guns, testosterone, blokes scratching their balls, horses, cowboy hats, all that. And one of the most important stories that's never been told in this country. But he says, let's get rid of the score. Let's never have a helicopter shot or some kind of point of view that the audience can't have because we're not eagles. And he says, I only have one rule apart from that. If my bum goes numb, the film is too long. Did it keep you entertained, Sophie?
Well, I hate to be like the cynical person here because, yeah, you really don't get very many films that deal with the plight of Australian Aboriginals. But everyone has their own taste in movies, and Guillermo del Toro said, your taste in movies is a quest. For me, a film can't just be important and an issue movie to appeal to me. It's a bonus if a film can shine a light on something in the world that can help you understand something of the world, but that should be a byproduct of storytelling. And I was on course to really like this movie. It's, the imagery of it is beautiful and majestic. You've got the red earth, these salt plains. You really have a sense of how beautiful yet how deadly the Australian landscapes are. And it seemed to be unfolding in this, even though it's dealing with this very harrowing subject. And Harry March, God, he was a villain and a half. And it really had me, because it seemed to be unfolding at a nice meditative pace and not throwing anything down your throat. Then it just kind of felt like Warwick Thornton didn't really know how to wrap up his themes, how to end the story. And it, compared to how elegant it had been, the ending just felt very clumsy. And in particular, this final payoff line from uttered by Sam Neill, I was repulsed by that. I mean, that's a strong word, repulsed. But Lynn Ramsey has faith in the power of images. It felt like at the last moment he had no faith in that beautiful images he had assembled and had to sort of tie it together in a way that was unsatisfying to me as a viewer.
All right. Okay. What numbers would you give this as a result?
Well, I've been hearing about this for a while. You know, it won prizes in Venice and Toronto. So anticipation, 3.5.
Mm-hmm.
Enjoyment, it was at 4, and then it went down to a 3. So 3.5, 3, in retrospect, 3.
Okay. What about you, Hannah?
Yeah, I didn't know much about it to start with, so probably a 3 for anticipation, and I think a 4 and a 4 for me. I think Sophie raised a lot of good points about it. I think the ending is quite clumsy. I will concede that, but I still think it's worth seeing, and I'm glad it's been made.
Yeah, absolutely stunning film visually, as you both touched on. I'd say, yeah, 3, 4, 4 for me as well. Luckily, you weren't there to point out just how bad the ending was for me, and I kind of sailed through that. Only now do I realise. But yeah.
It does all end in about 15 minutes for a 2-hour film, you know, for something. I was the same with Red Sparrow. My biggest pet peeve in cinema is when a film wraps up in like 10 minutes.
Oh, really?
After spending, you know, a long time with characters for everything to be resolved in like the last dying minutes. I'm like, really? Really? That's what you're going to do?
Pat endings. Okay. Huh. All right. I wonder what you'll make of Mom and Dad when you get the chance to see it. I've seen it, and so have you, Sophie. So let's chat about that after this. Mom and Dad is director Brian Taylor's volcano of midlife crisis-fueled resentment. Brent, played by Nicolas Cage, secretly longs for the days when he did donuts in his Trans Am while his teen girlfriend shoved her bosom in his face. Kendall, his wife, played by Selma Blair, feels empty and lost now that her kids are growing up and she has no career, while her relationship with her daughter, sulky Carly, is steadily deteriorating. Here's the moment when Kendall attempts to re-engage with the real world by going for a job interview.
Well, look at you.
Look at you. 2 kids.
I know. Ugh, hard to believe. And you have none?
Can't wrap my head around it.
Look, you either die single or you live long enough to see yourself become Le Cachet.
Stupid.
So, it's the best, huh?
It is, but they need you less and less. And that's sort of why I'm here today. Remember how you said, if ever I want to get back in?
Oh, Kendall, that was what, like 15 years ago?
Yeah, that's the ever part.
Look, Kendall, you are always a rock star to me, but this isn't something you can just jump back into.
I get it. You're going crazy.
Kids.
Crazy. Wow.
Sophie, Nicolas Cage said that this is his favourite movie that he's filmed in the last 10 years.
I think I would join him as my favourite Nicolas Cage movie in the last 10 years.
One of the many misdirections that Brian Taylor stages at the start of this film is the idea that it's going to be somehow a kind of Nicolas Cage readjusting to middle-aged life movie, because it really isn't. And having said that, I really enjoyed this film because I knew nothing about it going into it, so we should be really careful of how much we give away.
Well, I think that's hard because the central conceit is introduced probably within the first 10 minutes.
I didn't realise it was there.
Yes, but you are in a very rare situation. I think most people will know. I mean, we can try and talk around it, but I mean, that's the glee of it. You know, cinema can be a home for our most sentimental selves, and it can be a home for our least sentimental urges. And this is, I can't imagine a less sentimental concept than this, and executed with utter glee.
Executed being the word. It functions almost like, you know, quite often in films and television shows, there's a scene which shows you something quite remarkable, and then the character snaps out of it, and it's just been a reverie where they imagined what they'd like to do.
Right.
And this is basically 90 minutes of that.
Well, James, I think of the three of us here, you are the person I'd most like to ask about right. The Urges Unleashed. Could you relate to...
I think it's a very relatable film, and what's so clever about this film is that this is one of the most common sources of resentments, of bitternesses even. So many of your impulses growing up don't go away, but they get buried under the other responsibilities, the other urges of parenthood. And this is something that just never, it's been utterly taboo until now. But certainly for a mainstreamish film, and a film which is so gloriously, gleefully trashy almost,
yeah,
to pick up and just run amok with some of the ideas was great fun. Really liberating, actually.
Yeah, it's a very liberating film. I saw it in Toronto, and I'd been, what I mean is, like, when you see films in a festival, you're sort of a bit pummeled, and a lot of films just, it's a struggle to engage. This was just, like, this woke me up. I was like, Frankenstein's monster just sitting bolt upright, like, I'm alive. This movie made me feel alive.
Oh, well, that's great. I mean, it's not a perfect film by any means. Nicolas Cage is, well, Nicolas Cage. Yeah.
He does it. He's full Cage.
He is full Cage.
Yes.
But I think possibly Selma Blair and the daughter as well is very good. There are some good performances. There are some bits that are less well handled, but I think you can forgive the faults because of the neatness of the plotting, the originality of the idea. And in some ways, it maybe touches, again, without wishing to give too much away, it maybe touches in some of the same areas of kind of comedy, horror, satire that Get Out mined so successfully. And then the neatness of the plotting, I thought, was one of the really strong points of this film.
I wouldn't say it's a satire because I don't think it really delves into the logic of the premise. The premise just is.
Right.
And like, Get Out is a very intelligent exploration of something within society. And this is like, hey, this is a thing within society. Isn't it fun?
Kind of like The Purge. That's what we've had. Let's just run with it and see where we go.
And I'd like to... Can we just talk about how great it is that Nicolas Cage is Nicolas Cage?
Yeah, go ahead,
Sophie. In general.
Yeah. I think he has no vanity as a performer.
Oh, definitely not. I think even The Wicker Man, which a lot of people are rightly critical of, but his performance in that is like... He commits to everything he does, and I love that. I genuinely love that. I think he must be the most fun person to work with. Like, he's just earnest and all in, always. I'm so excited to see this film based on your reviews.
Now we've oversold it.
No, we've not oversold it. Because
I think we have.
I don't think we have, because I think Hannah knows that I'm not recommending the sophisticated, intelligent work of cinema. I'm recommending that something that's working on a more primal level. And it's so... It knows what it is and it knows what it's doing, and there's a glee in that.
Sometimes you need that. You need that from yourself.
We had that little chat at the start about whether there's ever been any good movies made out of video games, and if only someone had made the video game. This actually feels a little bit like watching a video game. It's got that kind of level of amoral commitment to sociopathic violence.
Yeah, gotta love that amoral commitment to sociopathic violence. And also the use of the song It Must Have Been Love. When you watch the film... And you see the use of that song in that scene. Ugh.
All right, well, we've probably said too much because I am concerned about when the opening titles rolled and they looked like a pretty cheesy Hollywood attempt to get in touch with its emotions type film. I really wondered if I was going to be doing that, do I walk out of a cinema or not? Question, conundrum. So I think the low expectations can be such a huge plus in terms of enjoying a film. I would hate to to build this one up too much. But what else would you like to say before we put numbers on it?
I'd just like to, in the whole Netflix, if you like this, you may like... There's this really great film from the 70s. Oh, the 70s, called Who Can Kill a Child? And that is a great film.
Okay. Also nice to see Lance Henriksen in this film, with a particularly winning turn as well. Yeah. Good. Sophie, did you give it numbers?
Anticipation, 2.5. I was like, what even is this? Enjoyment, 4?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Lovely time I had. In retrospect, 3.5.
Oh, okay. All right. I think I'd go 3.44, probably. Yeah. Good. Next, it's time to talk about our film club, which this week is the decidedly trashy One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
An opportunistic criminal played by Jack Nicholson pleads insanity after getting into trouble again and once in a mental institution rebels against the oppressive nurse, Nurse Ratched, and rallies the scared patients.
Mr. McMurphy, Your medication.
What's in the horse pill?
It's just medicine. It's good for you.
Yeah, but I don't like the idea of taking something if I don't know what it is.
Don't get upset, Mr. McMurphy.
I'm not getting upset, Miss Pilbo. It's just that I don't want anyone to try and slip me saltpeter. You know what I mean?
Murphy doesn't want to take his medication orally. I'm sure we can arrange that he can have it some other way. But I don't think you'd like it, Mr. McMurphy.
You'd like it, wouldn't you?
Well,
give it to me.
Good.
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which was the second of only three movies to win every single major Academy Award. That's Best Picture, Actor, Actress, Director and Screenplay, Adapted or Original. The other two, Sophie, save you having to ask, being It Happened One Night, back in 1934, and The Silence of the Lambs. Controversially, because I don't think it was all that, Silence of the Lambs.
We've had this conversation
know,
on
three separate podcasts
let's
now. Not bring
every time, we're just going to keep every week.
Brian Cox. Anyway, what did people think of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest? Sophie.
So we've got a hefty old email from Stuart Jones. Do I read it out in its entirety?
Well, you can cherry pick the best bits if you want, as is the fashion these days.
Yeah. I'm going to cherry pick the part where he says he's a big fan of the pod, because I think we all need that affirmation, because life is hard. And then he says that, although very well made and beautifully performed, I find One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest deeply problematic and have difficulties getting past its rather murky sexual and racial politics.
Ooh.
For a film regarded as such a classic of nonconformity and rebellion, it feels awfully reactionary and conservative in its overall worldview.
So which bit does Stuart particularly identify as reactionary then about the...
So a bunch of white men, all have been locked up because of women, wives, mothers, lying teenagers, rebel against their female oppressor and her black assistants. All of this is watched over by a silent, stoic, and therefore inherently wise and spiritual Native American.
Mm.
So he strips it back to the identity politics.
Said Native American was actually played by Will Sampson, who was actually was a park ranger in Oregon near where they were filming the movie, and they just needed a big man who looked Native American.
Wow, that's a spot of fortuitous casting, because I think he's really great in it.
Oh, yeah?
I think... he obviously doesn't have a lot to say. He is silent for most of the movie, but I was watching this half an hour before we recorded the podcast.
Ah, yeah. Good.
So it's very fresh in my mind. And he gives this really very subtle performance, almost like he wasn't acting. And I think he's the perfect foil to this manic Jack Nicholson, who is just like zooming around like a pinball.
I don't think it's aged particularly well. And I think it's almost, considering it, it's scooped 5 of the massive Academy Awards. I think it's that type of film that people feel good about aligning themselves to because it shows how anti-establishment they are. There's a kind of euphoria in identifying with the wild Randall P. McMurphy. And I think it's a really interesting film and he's a really interesting character because he's not an angel and he's not presented as an angel and yet still you feel for him. So I appreciate the spiky main character. I don't have that much to say about it.
Well, let's see what listeners had to say about it then.
We got a comment from Angus Davies who says, there's little to be said for One for the Cuckoo's Nest that hasn't already been said. One of the great all-time ensemble performances, in my opinion, and my favourite Nicholson performance bar Chinatown. Hmm. It's a perfectly alchemical, he's written. I'm not sure that's what it's. It's a perfectly alchemic blend of brutal melancholy and emphatic hilarity.
Oh.
Now, my mum worked in a psychiatric ward in the 80s, right. And we've talked about this film many times because she has always said, like, it's pretty accurate as to the kind of stuff that went on in her ward. You know, there was a lot of horribly sad things happening and a lot of horrible things happening to people on the ward. That was the state of mental health care in the 80s. But it was also very funny at times. Funny things happened. The patients were funny. And I think the sympathy does come across. One of the things I think that makes me feel like that, though, is probably the score, which I had forgotten how good the music is in this film. It's by Jack Nietzsche, who did it with a bone saw, I think, and wine glasses. There's this kind of like, it feels like a theremin sound, like going throughout. And he kind of wanted to try and capture this sort of offbeat, slightly weird tone. But yeah, I love the music in it. I think it is quite schmaltzy in some places, but I really like it anyway.
The characterizations are all pretty superficial. They're very boisterous people with one or two big identifiers. So even though it's set in a mental institution and Ken Kesey worked in one and he wrote...
Although he was so upset, and he was saying with the way that the filmmakers had treated his story that he refused to ever see it.
Yeah, he was involved in pre-production and then he had a big falling out, I think, with the film studios and he said he would never ever watch the film. He was very, very unhappy about it, which is, you know, totally fair. He was also, we were talking before the pod, he was involved in a government project called MK Ultra, which was where they used LSD on psychiatric patients. And I think Sophie's completely right. Yeah, all the characters bar Randall McMurphy and to a lesser extent Nurse Ratched, I think she is a bit of a, like, you know, caricature. They don't really have a performance. It's interesting because they waited for Jack Nicholson to become available. They waited quite some time. And they said, like, oh, it was really good that we had to wait because we got the ensemble cast just right. And I was like, well, yeah, the cast is brilliant, but they're not given much to do apart from kind of act.
It's amazing cast as well.
Yeah, Danny DeVito. Yeah, very, very young Danny DeVito.
Christopher Lloyd. Brad Dourif. Yeah.
He was great.
Louise Fletcher, who plays Nurse Cratchit, a role that was originally intended for Lily Tomlin, and my mind is blown.
I didn't know that.
Louise Fletcher was in preparation to begin filming Nashville, and Lily Tomlin was going to do One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and then they swapped. I don't know why.
She could have had an Oscar for that.
Well, maybe, but that...
Different things would have been.
That would have needed some acting, wouldn't it? Lily Tomlin is...
I think Lily Tomlin's...
She could do it, though.
I think she could have done
Can
it.
I give a revisionist read on her character? Because she's billed as one of the great villains of cinema history. But you could spin it like, here's this woman in this position of power, and here's this upstart who... You know, it's part of his character. He's been done for statutory rape, you know. So this guy comes along, this charismatic guy, stirs up all the guys, leads a rebellion against her, and she's just trying to keep order.
There's a moment in the film where they're having a discussion about McMurphy and whether or not to ship him off to another facility. And she says, I think we can help him. Like, I think he should stay here. And I think I had kind of forgotten, because she is always billed as, like, oh, one of cinema's top villains. She's not really a villain. Like, she gets treated pretty appallingly by him and by the other patients, by everyone. It must have been...
He tries to kill her.
Yeah. It must have been very, very, very difficult to be a woman working on a male psychiatric ward. In fact, it was. My mum did it. And she said the patients were like, you know, and even some of the other staff. I'd no respect for the women that worked there.
I see a reboot, a modern version, telling it from Nurse Ratched's point of view. Lynn Ramsey obviously is the director.
I'd like to see a woman tell the story.
I've got Joaquin Phoenix as the Indian chief, just smouldering there silently. And of course, Nick Cage is the Jack Nicholson.
He is. And of course, the commentary the film makes is that the film is not blind to the fact that Randall McMurphy is flawed. And the point it seems to be making is that, and it's a good point, it doesn't really matter what type of a person this person is. He still deserves better treatment than he ends up getting. And the system is bad. And, you know, thank God we don't use electric shock treatment on patients anymore or lobotomies. And this is a protest film in a way against these inhuman techniques. That's the broad point that it makes, and that's a good point to make. But I think you could still make that point within a film that has more balanced perspectives, and I think free Nurse Ratched from her great cinema villains landing post.
One of the things it does well is the commentary on institutionalisation and the character of Billy Bibbit, who is the sort of the stuttering youth who's got a very, very bad relationship with his mother by the sound of things. And the chief as well, these people that have been in institutions that kind of their whole life. And you see this again in, I was watching The Shawshank Redemption a couple of weeks ago, and the character of Red, who spent his whole life basically in prison, and what this does to people and how it makes it so they can't function in the real world. And that this is still obviously an ongoing concern in society, is how can we provide treatment to people in psychiatric hospitals and people that have gone into prison and ensure that they are able to go back to a life after they come out of these institutions, which are not meant to be permanent.
No. Well, some major themes there. Still, next week, Street Fighter, eh?
It's nice to do something light, isn't
it? Yeah, that's true. All right, then. Well, there you go. Many thanks for your comments, everyone. So next week, we'll be back talking about Street Fighter, but also some big films coming out. There's The Square, which I think you've both seen. Is that right?
Yes.
Good monkey in The Square.
Good monkey.
Great sex scene.
Ooh. Oh, the sex scene's so good.
Wow, all right. Tomb Raider, which probably also involves monkeys and possibly sex scenes. I don't know. We've not been given access to a screening yet, but fingers crossed, A. And Mary Magdalene, which I'm thinking probably has less of both. Yeah. Have you seen Mary Magdalene yet?
I have not, but big fan of Joaquin, obviously. Quite. You're shifting gear next week with all the old
Joaquin. And his
girlfriend,
partner.
Rooney Mara.
Right,
yeah, Rooney playing Mary Magdalene, and he's playing Cheeky Jesus. Cheeky Jesus. He just looks a bit cheeky.
Okay. All right. Wow. We'll see how cheeky next week on Truth and Movies. If you have any thoughts, you can email us at truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or send us a tweet at LWLies or post a comment on the website. Anything else we should discuss before we press the button mark stop? Hannah?
Yes. So our new issue of Little White Lies magazine is coming out tomorrow. And
it is
a tribute to Wes Anderson's new film, Isle of Dogs. So you can read Sophie's lovely interview with Mr. Wes Anderson himself and his collaborators, Jason Schwartzman and Roman Coppola.
Oh, did you interview all of them?
I did.
Okay. All right.
So you read that and you read my review of the film and you can read some great dog content, lots of dog content in this month.
Okay. So. Well, have you done a kind of canine special, no doubt with the film?
Sadly not.
Oh,
we did do a timeline of great movie dogs, though, which has been illustrated. It's really nice. And
okay.
It's just a great read. I know I worked
starting
there,
from Digby and then working down?
Starting with The Tramp. The Charlie Chaplin film,
I believe. There's a lot of canon, actually,
I wrote this timeline, and it was about 100 films. Lots of dogs is the takeaway.
Were you dreaming of dogs?
I was, you know. It's been quite a 2 months.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to that. That's out on Friday,
out on shelves on Friday.
Super. Sophie, how about you? You off to some exotic locale to watch films 6 months ahead of the rest of us soon?
No, in fact, I feel some existential malaise because I've just finished a big project and now I'm contemplating the void that is my future.
Oh, wow. Okay. Welcome to the real world then. All right. Well, this and much more to come next week when we return to the wacky world of the Little White Lies family in Truth and Movies. In the meantime, this has been a 7 Digital production.
Hey, Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.